I'm certain that Dar Williams needs no introduction, and I don't want to read a formal, fussy bio, because that's not what tonight is about. It's about celebrating her latest chapter as urban theorist and perhaps future urban planner, because I know I would love to visit Dar Williamsville, USA. I'm just saying, just putting it out there. But she's here to discuss this urgent, I would say gently urgent, in a gentle Dar Williams way, new book. And I love this book, and not just because what we can learn from it, but also because what it says to me about its author. What in-demand, internationally touring singer-songwriter is selling out music venues and headlining festivals and signing autographs and looking out into the audience and thinking about us? She's thinking about our towns, our communities, where we are from, and what we can do to improve our cafes, our Capitol buildings, our public parks, and actually want to share it with us and put it in a book so that we can learn from her vision, her insights into all that she's seen in America's lively and resilient communities. That person is Dar Williams, and I am so thrilled to introduce her tonight. Please help me welcome her. Thank you.
Interesting thing to do. As I was writing, I was like, songs are so easy to write. And now that I'm writing songs again, I'm like, books are so easy to write. So this is a new part of my act. I did a show, like a practice show, and I was talking to the people after the practice show to see what they thought I could use, and they're like, "Well, you gave really great examples of what of what you were talking about, but you never said what you were talking about. What's your book about?" So this is a little wonky, but this is just part of the introduction to let you know kind of what brought this book into being. You know, I really wanted somebody to write this book, and then I realized I couldn't. No, I had no takers, so. Basically, I discovered something. You know, I would go to towns, and actually, you know, Heidi was talking about how I, you know, have done all this touring, and then I was surprisingly sort of looking at you and looking at your towns. A lot of musicians do that. We kind of feel towns out, and we kind of feel if they feel like this or if they kind of feel like this. And it's so nice to go to a place where we feel welcome. You know, there are good signs, you know, good people. You see dog walkers talking to dog walkers. Not every window says bathrooms for customers only. So the towns, and you know, you get a sense that if somebody wants to fix a crack in the sidewalk, people look at it and they say, how are we going to fix that? You know, there's this real sense of we're in this, you know, the solutions are ours. So I call this thing, that I've sensed in places positive proximity. And this is sort of the derivation of it. So positive proximity is the state of being where living side by side with other people is experienced as beneficial. I have been seeing this phenomenon of town building for more than 20 years. Someone starts something, others join in, and then everything starts to shift into more clarity, more resilience, more goodwill, and more pride. Libraries find their way into the digital age. Schools improve. People actually sit and eat ice cream on the benches, eerily empty for years. I've seen the power of positive proximity firsthand in hundreds of towns, such as Lowell, Massachusetts, hit with the twin degradations of industrial downturns and a crack epidemic in the 1990s. I saw it in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, where after the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company left the state in 1995, the promoters of my near-empty concert were vowing that they would revive the city through the arts. Good luck with that, I thought. They did have very good luck with that. I didn't understand the power of the positive proximity I had witnessed until I was having dinner at my friend Kate's house in Charlottesville, Virginia. Her husband, Hal Movius, who writes books about conflict resolution, filled my wine glass and asked, "What do you think determines the relationships we'll have in our towns?" Hal loves to pour through Harvard studies and explain them to dinner guests. I said, "Values? No. Politics? No again. Hobbies? Wrong." Hal said, "Proximity, that's all." I disagreed. Into my mind came full-blown images provided by news headlines of neighbors fighting over parking spaces and fallen tree branches. I just heard the story of a company that could identify DNA in dog poop so people could know the genetic fingerprint, as it were, of the anonymous offenses in their courtyards. Early clients were co-op associations. But then I realized with a jolt, the study that Hal was referring to was right. When people transcend the myth that proximity means conflict and invasion of privacy, they gravitate toward finding ways to integrate the talents and skills of their community members. Not only that, after people discover each other in the commons of town, more connections are made. And the next thing you know, you're Lowell, Massachusetts, that small city that had a terrible drug problem, but now has five museums, a popular minor league stadium and team, and a free concert series that attracts thousands of families every summer. I see towns and cities as being like people who build some framework of identity that allows them to assert themselves, do good work, and know where they stand. I find myself almost befriending them, wanting to introduce them to each other. Peoria, Illinois, have you met Cedar Rapids, Iowa? Seattle, Washington, you have some interesting things in common with Asheville, North Carolina. Gardner, Maine, I think Dover, New Hampshire, could provide some helpful insights as you continue the winning streak you're on with your downtown. So that's where we're coming from here. So what happened? Where was I? I know what happened. This is what happened. I was going out with my manager, so I didn't get that memo. But it was great going out with my colleague. And we were in the middle of the country, and he was showing, you know, we were going through all these downtowns on the way to Earlham College in Indiana. And he said, this is the future of the United States. And what we were looking at were all of these main streets that were boarded up with graffiti on the plywood. I mean, it looked like it was pretty long gone. And he said, well, the big boxes are here. And I said, what's a big box? So what happened before the big boxes was the closing of the mills and the factories and the mines as well. And then the malls came along and said, here, let's take the rest of the life out of the downtown. And then the big boxes were this sort of ancillary thing as well. So by 1994, that's what downtowns look like. And so I despaired. I love Charlie. I wanted to show him that I was witnessing his despair. So I wrote a really depressing song that I'm not even going to go through the whole song. It's too depressing. But it's called Bought and Sold. So then, lo and behold, I was performing in Keene, New Hampshire, and I watched how they had kind of gotten their skill sets together to make, you know, restore an old theater. I think it's either vaudeville or an opera house in the middle of this kind of sleepy college town. And it was impressive. And everybody was finding their role and making it happen. And not only that, they were all talking about stuff that was happening in town, you know, this little landscaping project and this little store coming in. And it was so cool to see all that buzzing, not just about the fact that they'd found out how to get this concert venue up, but that they were then figuring out, now that they had all those dovetailing skill sets, how to do other stuff. And I thought, I think this is how things happen. And sure enough, you know, all these towns that I go to, you come back and it's a little less sleepy, a little bit more buzzy, more flowers, more stores, more local pride. Then you get the garlic festivals, the apple and the mushroom festivals, and the big bulletin boards that are filled with flyers and you know, all of that stuff. So I identified what I thought would help bring that buzz to the downtowns, which is not people choosing to get along. I think that's a tall order. And I don't even, you know, there, I don't really like some people in my town, and I don't want to like them. But I love them because they're very organized, you know? And so I'll have an idea and they can organize it. So I love them, and I don't want to hang beyond the event until I need some more organization. So basically what I found was that if there's a project that can bring you together, you know, in terms of what builds the identity of your town. Usually you move someplace because there's something about it you love. You know, that those projects will lead to more connections and lots of cool things. Spaces, there are certain spaces that allow people to meet one another. Dog runs, I think, are a great example, because what are you going to do? Just stand there if your dog's sniffing another dog. You'll start a conversation just to, for the awkwardness alone. So, you know, there's all sorts of things that create certain kinds of conversations. And then finally, there's this thing I call translation, which is how we find avenues of involvement ourselves, and also how we create points of access for others, so that once you see and sense that panorama of your community, I'm a folk singer, that once you sense that panorama, you think, this person feels left out. This person is, you know, somehow not feeling connected. And I feel like that person wants to. So how do we bring that person in? How do we bring in more skill sets? How do we bridge? So that's what I call translation. How do we translate ourselves out and help people translate themselves in? Those are hallmarks of very successful, really exciting communities. So since we're in a kind of a place where the business is a specific thing, I was going to sort of read how I describe sort of the identity building projects and the importance of them in terms of how they relate to democracy. So this is called identity building. Flowers are neutral, my friend Denise says. She was talking about her county revitalization group, Sullivan Renaissance, in the beleaguered Catskill region of New York. They had been planting colorful flower and tree beds at the off-ramps on Route 17. This planting was the result of a group of people stepping back to see what might raise the visibility and morale of the beautiful but struggling Borscht Belt, as that region is sometimes known, named for the predominantly Jewish summer vacation land of the mid-20th century. But it was about more than the plants. This project demonstrated that citizens could create their own beauty and attract other people like themselves who would be willing to put in time for the public good. It drew people onto common ground and introduced them to other people who might have had no more in common than their interest in gardening and being involved with their town in some way. And the planting provided an opportunity for a community conversation. Identity building projects are by nature more proximally oriented than partisan divided. Towns cannot create civic engagement from scratch. Without positive proximity, there can be no grist for civic connections, and there are all too many opportunities for us to withdraw from the commons before properly examining what we might find there. We can easily prefer a relationship with the smooth-riding electronic highway of online communities that can be navigated from one's couch. But when there is a project afoot, even out on the bumpiest of social surfaces, citizens can leave their houses, acting in their own interests at first, but often pushing past the known frontiers into new relationships and challenges. Then they can experience positive proximity firsthand. Enhancing the identities of our town through a range of projects humanizes them by bringing together names, faces, and skill sets. With these projects, local government becomes a recognizable part of local experience too, and the idea of local office is less daunting. Self-government is part of the organism that is community. We the people means people like us. That guy who stands up and calls the mayor a fascist every month or so? That's just Bill. He volunteered for the community pancake breakfast in March. He's a good man who maybe dropped a little too much acid a few decades ago. Bill rants. Bill taps our maple trees without asking permission and gives us a bottle of syrup from them every March. Bill's okay. Oh, and that council member? We planted flowers together. So that's the kind of thing I encountered, you know, people who'd sort of found themselves and then even found themselves running for office. One of the guys who was part of this flower planting project in Sullivan County was apparently very shy, but kept on talking to people and meeting people and sort of seeing the community humanize itself and not be so daunting. And then he ran for local office because he saw the need and he stepped up. So this is an example of how Phoenixville, Pennsylvania, one of my favorite towns. Has anyone here been to Phoenixville, Pennsylvania? It's great, right? So they had a steel mill that closed almost overnight. And Eli, the guy who ran the coffee house, he goes, I don't want to incriminate myself, but Phoenixville is where you went to get your drugs. That's what happened. You know, steel mill closes overnight, three shifts, you know, three lines of lunch bags at the local cafe. All of that's gone overnight. All sorts of traffic, as they say. Nobody wants to go through. And then they come back slowly. One of the ways they did it was to make it a historically designated area to protect the architecture. And then they started to fill that architecture with really interesting stories and their lives. And one of the places they filled up was the Colonial Theater, which is where, around which the, well, I'll tell you what happened. So they brought back this vaudeville theater. It's a community representative, and it was bought by a nonprofit local group, you know, sold to the community for $1, and then the community really ran with it. It's a community representative kaleidoscope of events and audiences that passes through every day. The staff has been receptive to people's ideas and wish lists, so there are first-run movies, a classic film on Sundays, children's movies on Saturday during the school year, and then there's the weird stuff. The theater hosts the first Friday night, Fright Night. Mary, who runs the theater, said, Mary said, a group of young men who love that kind of film came to us, and now they program it for us. They come up with the ideas. Also, after they realized First Friday Fright Night was about one kind of cult film and that there were other kinds of cult films they wanted, we added a third Friday, which is Cult Night. She sounded a bit like a mother who affably mixes up fake blood for her son's zombie costume and helps him construct the cardboard and foil axe to plant in his head. Another reason the Colonial thrived was that the staff seized upon the opportunity to feature and truly celebrate one of the lead actors from Phoenixville. Not only that, the actor had a famous movie scene that took place in the Colonial Theater itself. Mary and friends took those bona fides and ran with them. In the 1950s, there was a Christian film company just outside of town called Good News Productions. The members were a tight-knit community who ate together, worshiped together, and made low-budget sci-fi movies together. One film, directed by Irvin Yeaworth, did better than the other ones did. This one had a young Steve McQueen in it. This one had a theme song co-written by Burt Bacharach. This film, The Blob, created an international film star, The Blob itself, born in Chester County, Pennsylvania. When the Colonial reopened in 2000, newly opened by its nonprofit community group, its members were given a copy of The Blob by the son of the director. They got a call from NPR asking how they might celebrate Steve McQueen's upcoming birthday. The staff members turned the screening into an event with the seductive title Blobfest. After selling out two screenings of the movie the first year, the staff members knew they had something special on their hands. Audiences loved being in the theater where a famous scene was shot, even staking out the seats where the character sat. Blobfest grew like The Blob, becoming a weekend-long multimedia celebration every July. When I got to Blobfest in 2014, Chuck Francisco was holding down the fort, but he talked me through Friday night as they were setting up the stage with a game show spinning wheel, drums, and mics. One of the female performers was already in her taffeta skirt and bouffant wig as she directed stagehands with the props. Chuck talks me through this whole thing. And he says, this place will just fill up with people who are going to have a good time, and then it culminates at 9 o'clock with the run out. At 9 p.m., it's time for the audience to flee. In the movie, there's a scene where the blob oozes through the air vents like a giant melting red naugahyde couch. Reenacting the sci-fi teen terror of being absorbed into the blob, the present-day audiences stream through the lobby in a frenzied panic. The heavy glass doors burst open. Outside, thousands of people await, cell phone cameras rising in the air to greet 700 people as they run screaming from the building en masse. Some people scream persuasively. Some could use a little practice. Other people have a special thing they do. There's this big older guy who has the largest popcorn bucket, Chuck said, and his thing is to run confused, turn around, and throw popcorn in the air, and then go in the other direction. And he does it every year.
So,
you know, the examples, every city the editor said, you know, find a city that exemplifies what you want to, what you've seen that's so effective. And this is a town that's taken history, architectural, preservation on the one hand, Blobfest on the other. They burn a giant phoenix. They have a really great historical society. I mean, there's all these different ways that they have used history to bring the town back. And now everyone wants to live in Phoenixville. Moab, Utah, you know, found a way to harness tourism around its beautiful nature, its rivers and its red rocks and everything. And now they are 7,000 people who host 1.5 million people a year, and that's actually a problem. But but this idea of finding ways to be, you know, to create hometown pride and worldly welcome. That's what I've seen in these 21st century towns when they dig into these kinds of projects. You know, they find these aspects of their identity, they build the identity, and then they welcome the world in, and then that there's that positive feedback loop where they're letting in new ideas to feed on the old. And in Phoenixville, they have the Colonial Theater, but they have a lot of ceramicists who moved in over the last few decades. So now they also have something called the Firebird Festival, where the whole town comes together to build an 18-foot-high phoenix. And underneath that phoenix, when the phoenix caves, it does the second firing of little ceramic birds that everybody makes. And they dig them out in the morning. And the police have finally said, you know, we're going to do that for you. They really make sure that fire's out. And then they go into that slurry and they dig out these ceramic birds that people have made, because this is the new history over the last few decades. So, you know, it's watching towns grow like this is the reason I wanted to write about them. So this is something that I saw when I was in, you know what? I'm going to let it go. Something cool in Florida. So besides alligators, which are like everywhere. I mean, that's quite a state. So actually, why don't we see if there are any questions or thoughts that you have? If in terms of like, some people want to ask me about my music career, or my personal life. So I weigh about 120, although I just was in the Midwest and I gained a few pounds, a lot of donuts. I am still in touch with my old babysitter, and I live in Cold Spring, New York. So, I used to be like the Hudson Valley, but you know, everyone knows where I live. So, any questions, thoughts? Hi, Sally. Oh goodness. Yeah. Oh, very good. Ah, hey.
I'm wondering if you had any thoughts about whether that landscape, in part, as a country, separates us while it gathers us locally, or you don't find that to be the case?
I don't find that to be the case for the same reason that I encourage people to have, you know, food festivals. You know, people ask about a lack of density. You know, if you don't have a lot of population density, how do you find that commons? And I always encourage, you know, sort of a food festival that gets you kind of dug in with your regional identity. If you have blue potatoes and those people have red potatoes, and oh, there you go. you find the thing that you're proud of. And I mean, like, I was just up around Philly and in Kennett Square, and they were talking about this mushroom festival that they had, and somebody said, a mushroom festival? And the guy got so reverent. He said, oh yes, we are one of the biggest mushroom growers in North America. It's amazing. We have a 3-pound per capita mushroom harvest in this, you know, in the month of something alone. And so they have this festival, and my sense is that if you have something that you celebrate about where you are, and you're proud of it, so you want people to come see what's going on with you, and you feel, and also, you know, like I go to the Southwest, and desert people are desert people, you know, they just love the fact that they're desert people. I'm a river person, and I love those desert people, and I think that's so interesting, and odd, but they think I'm very odd, you know, for really always wanting to live near a river. And I say, well, I'm from the United States, and I come from the Hudson Valley, and we have Pete Seeger, and we have, you know, these great mountains, and we have the Adirondacks, and you have, you know, these things. It makes me feel more American, but my sense is that it makes them feel more American too, because it's like we are all squares of a patchwork. I think the only problem that people get into is that they get really excited about their trails and stuff, and then people fall off of them and they have to hire extra ambulance services, and they resent that. But there's a certain pride, like, this is how you do our landscape. But no, I get a sense that people, I think ideally people find what they find, but then there are people amongst them who like to bring, to bridge to other things. And there's other things that can isolate people in here. But I think that landscape, especially when experienced, you know, becomes a point of connection, because there's something kind of in the gut and even spiritual about it. And Sally, did you? Oh, hi.
So I wanted to ask what might be a hard question about sort of towns, and sort of about the tension between old and new,
mm-hmm.
and not just in a cultural sense, but also I think like economically, when towns revitalize, that also often means gentrification and displacement, mm-hmm. and
right.
sort of how you've seen that sort of been balanced and done well or done poorly, and any thoughts you have on that?
Well, you know, I had a revelation recently, and we were talking about this in Beacon, New York, because Beacon has gone fast, and now everyone's all bummed out. And you know, and everyone kind of looks like you. You know, the cool, the you know, the nice glasses, and the tasteful facial hair, and an earring, and you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. But they're young, and then the people look at the shops and they say, oh, there's a lot of candles. You know, I want to buy a shovel. I don't want to buy a candle shaped like a shovel, you know. I realized something, though. That's not the hipster's fault, you know, that there are these trendy stores. That's Walmart's fault, because insofar as you have, you don't have what they have in Pittsfield, Massachusetts still, which is like Jim's House of Shoes. Yeah. Oh, very good. Okay. So they have Jim's House of, you know, back in the day, it's like you could buy your shovels downtown. You don't do that anymore. So what do they do to keep the pulse of the downtown? They have, you know, goat milk, you know, they have, you know, vegan, cruelty-free candles shaped like cupcakes and things like that. Ideally, though, when we were talking about it in Beacon, you'll have something that sells the basics. I call it the resident relevant basics. And a woman raised her hand and said, what about a general store? Why can't we encourage the general stores of the 21st century? So I'm going to write a blog about hipsters opening general stores, because they have goat farms. I mean, it's easier to have a general store. Is it, well, you know what, and it's probably a bar at night, right? You know, yeah, it's probably a brewery, but that is the 21st century one, you know, and so that's one thing. How do we bring resident relevant aspects of commerce into things so that people can still buy aspirin, so that you can truly have a pedestrian town? So that's one question to tackle, but really displacement. Like, let's not even call it gentrification, because some people think gentrification is good. I don't, you know, as a term, I think it's pejorative. But everybody's trying to tackle that right now. And all I can say is that if you have, there's a difference between improvement and gentrification. People improve their communities. They have, you know, a lot of prostitution and drugs and things. And then they bring it to this next thing of viability, stability. They have streetlights. They have a local economy. They have people participating. They're proud to live there. Ideally, there's a magic moment when you realize that before the bulldozers come in, of developers who can smell that stuff. For, you know, they smell the basil, they smell the Chardonnay, and they come in and they do a lot of, I mean, they'll get personal. That's what happened in our town. And they'll split demographics and say, you've been here for 40 years, you've been here for 4 years, look how divided you are. You know, you have this political belief, you have this one, look how divided you are. People are like this, and then the developers or the outside influence comes in and, you know. Because it's easier, widens the streets for the bulldozers to come in. So you got to watch out for that. And then you got to go with the solutions that people have right now for bringing in, you know, ways to stabilize the price of real estate. And that's just a thing. And everyone cares about it, which is really nice. Every town cares about it, but they don't have, you know, but it's coming up. And people do get displaced. So, you know, all I can say is that there's no silver bullet, but there's a lot of interesting buckshot out there. Yes, hi.
So I have two quick questions. And my first one is, how long does it normally take you to write a song?
Somewhere between a month and 2 years. Mm-hmm. So there are people who believe that you should be able to write them very fast, and I don't. So, and I'm glad to say that to a young person because, you know, I think some people are like, when you really have a great idea, it's like a bolt of lightning. The first inspiration is a bolt of lightning, but then I like to embroider a lot and let it kind of come to me slowly, and that can be a month to 2 years.
And then my other question is, what are you normally inspired by to write your songs?
Really unusual stuff. Something will just hit me. And what I try to do, if I were... At some point, I want to write a songwriting book, and I want to, and the first line is going to be, "Don't write every day." You know, that's, you have to sit down and write every. I can't, but I try to court inspiration every day. So I try to go to museums and places where people are thinking in different ways, because that automatically opens a window for my brain to think in a different way. And then something, a color or a moment. You know, I was on a show today where I was talking about the beauty of the rain. Which is something I wrote, and it just, I was so struck by the feeling of the way people talk to each other on rainy days on the city streets, and it sort of took on a little rainy feel and a rainy melody and became my rainy song that took about 4 months to write. So it's like I have to open a window to remember how cool it is to think poetically about things, and then weird stuff will, you know, maybe the cupcake candle will inspire me. Some story will start to form in my head. Good questions. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering what inspired you to finally write a book.
There was that sense. Well, I'd written a couple of young adult novels, and
I read one of your other books in class too. We had it as a class project.
Oh, fantastic.
I read Lights, Camera, Amelie.
Oh, good. Okay, so.
Yeah.
So learning how to sit down and write a book was a thing that I had learned how to do. Basically, it requires, you know, hot chocolate and a good cafe. And so I learned that I could. And then I did a blog about green technology. And I interviewed people. Interviewed Dana Rohrabacher, the congressman, and we talked about hemp. He's like, I don't give a damn if people want to smoke pot in their backyards. I was like, I will not quote that, but good to know. And so that kind of showed me what I could sit down and do in terms of research and interviewing people, so that when I thought, I really want to write this book because I've watched these towns evolve over 20 years. Mm-hmm. I realized that that's what I wanted to do, that I wanted to be that person who did it. And I found what's nice, and I hope you find this as well, I have friends who believe in me. So anything I want to do, I have a group of 10 friends who say, well, then you should do that. And my sisters who say, Dar, we've known you for your whole life. You have to do what you want to do because those are the things that you've done best.
Hi, what have you seen citizens do when the city fathers or mothers want to get rid of that old theater for a run-of-the-mill office block or tear down the old bank that stood at the major intersection for 100 years and put up a drive-in pharmacy or something.
Right. I will say this. The ideal is that you have your positive proximity in place before that challenge occurs. So here's an example. You got Staunton, Wisconsin. They have a town hall that with an opera house, an old 19th century opera house built on top of it. And it's exquisite, you know, it's weird and it's cool. And it makes sense because they share a heating system in Wisconsin and you have to go through the town hall to get up to the theater, which reminds you that these are your neighbors, this is your government. I mean, everything works. It was totally going to be raised, of course, right? So, because who wouldn't want to raise that building and build, you know, put a big cinder block nothing in its place? So the town agitated to do it. And I think about what was in place before that happened. They have a senior center that's right on the main street. I mean, it's really, and I advocate for senior centers being as close to the pedestrian center of town as possible so that there's maximum involvement. So that's going on. They have this thing called Sitsen May, which is Norwegian's founding day. And it brings in Norwegian music, Norwegian dancing, a troll painting contest for five-year-olds, a 5K run, a 10K run. So that's all different kinds of demographics. Every year, there's a ton of planning. There's a ton of communication and dovetailing of ages and background. Well, not so much backgrounds, probably kind of Norwegian, but that's a big part of their area. And, you know, parents and children and people learning dances and learning songs. So I thought, I think that they were interwoven by the time that challenge came up so that they looked at each other and said, do you want to get rid of that building? I don't want to get rid of that building. And they knew who could paint the signs and they knew who could make the posters and they knew who could be the advocate and they knew members of the city council. And lo and behold, it's the town pride, of course, because that's, you know, lead and asbestos are the enemies of history and some things do have to be torn down. And that's really sad. But a lot of times it's just that there isn't that fabric in place. And, you know, I would say think in bridges to save things. So if you want to save a building, think about visiting the senior center, the community center, the YMCA. Think of as many different constituencies as possible that might have a vested interest in that so that when you go in, you're really representing this wide swath of the community. But it's going to take what I call a conscious bridger. I have all sorts of terminology that I made up. It's going to require a conscious bridger, somebody who actually enjoys, you know, finding all of those things. You know, Malcolm Gladwell has names for them too, like a macha and all this stuff. But basically, you're going to have to find someone who's going to want to go into the elementary school and get them to write the letters. And you're going to go into this place and get the town historian on board and those things. In and of itself, you're bringing in a lot of interesting information, but you're also creating that lattice work, and it does save buildings. It's shocking what people point to and say that almost got torn down. That happens in every place that I visit too. They go, oh, by the way, that was almost torn down. I was like, well, that's the Taj Mahal. I'm like, yep, exactly. So well, it's a good question and a good cause.
Hi. I don't have like a specific question, but I'm from Northampton. I live in Holyoke. I just thumbed through your book and saw your little
blurbs
there, Paper City. And what you said about Northampton is so very true. And we were just discussing how gentrified it is. And where my son went to school, they say, oh, you know, we're so diverse. And I was like, there's no diversity here. The only people of color have been adopted by rich white people. And so we struggle with, you know, you get a festival or a thing to bond around and it's a very liberal community and there's strength in that, but what needs to happen isn't happening. And you mentioned other small towns like Turner's Falls. You're familiar with the Shea Theater and what's going on there. And so now in Holyoke, we've got Gateway City Arts, but we're not getting this sense of community and the excitement behind things. And I guess I'm asking that you were talking about you have friends that back you and say, go do whatever it is you're going to do. And I just want to ask that you ask your friends and your musician friends to seek out more of those weird small venues like Gateway City Arts and stop going to places like Iron Horse Productions and places that will support those communities that are building and are trying and Yeah. Not sure, well, where I'm going with that.
No, no, no. But that's, I mean, that's another kind of blog that I want to write. There's this thing where some, well, you know, sometimes somebody finds low rent in an area and it's got all sorts of stuff going on because, and you know, it's, there are all different kinds of incomes, all kinds of different backgrounds in those places. And then you look at the coffee house that they put in and it's John Gorka and Lucy Kaplansky and Dar Williams. And you're like, oh, a bunch of white people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And you're like, and that doesn't look like the neighborhood. So my ideal is that, I mean, I love going to places like that. And they always bring me in because I look, you know, I don't look like Judy Collins, you know. They're always like, ah, dark and swing with it. She's tolerant. She likes urban planning. So I go a lot of, yeah, cold green rooms. And so I've seen a lot of places. I mean, a lot of times you don't really know. You just get an invitation and you say yes or no based on the offer. So, but you can put in an extra pitch and say, we're really special. But the ideal also is if you have a viable thing, bring in the community that's all around as well, with open mics, letting kids open for those artists. So get the artists interested, but also find ways to get the, ask the artists to stay an extra day and do a songwriting thing. You know, make it more community representative as well as, and then you'll get both. That
or maybe also seeking, you know, at least, you know, one or two weird little places that are trying to come back and squeezing them in between, like, oh, we're driving from here to here, but we can.
Yes, yes. You know, make yourself route well,
yeah,
for sure. Yes. I mean, we can talk. I mean, I can give you some tips about how to make yourself a little bit more flashy for those of us who want something to do on a Wednesday. but somebody said, well, you know, we're a bookstore, so we're seen as part of the problem. I was like, I'm sorry, back it up.
Yeah.
What? You know, again, just because, and it was a bookstore that was run by a real gamut of ages, a lot of women of color, and they were really into the kids section and all these programs. And I was like, no, a bookstore is never the problem, and stop that.
Never, ever,
so,
ever.
You know. So this way of sort of making fun of the bourgeois bookstore, no, and it's same for a theater. There's all this potential, but sometimes they really just. I mean, that's not what you're talking about. I'd say both.
Yep.
You know, find ways to get participation and then also get outside people in and find that meeting of the two worlds. That's what I hope for the 21st century concert venue. I think that's Sally has one more question and then good.
Just one more. So I grew up in a small town, which was great, but a little stifling at times. And now I live in a small town, which is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but it's adjacent to here, which is a big city, which is also awesome. So the thing that I was wondering about when I was reading your book is there some sort of ideal size for a town to be able to build community and have positive proximity, do you think?
You know, a little more is good. I mean, you know, density is an issue. But, you know, I've seen a lot of density with very little life. So I mean, where's your campfire is maybe the real question. And how do you draw in the world to yourself? And how do you, you know, the more the merrier in terms of making your tomato festival, your garlic festival work. But it is, you know, our town is 9,000. And we have another town that's 15,000 to the north. And that's enough to fill a calendar with. And I would really hope, that you could do anything with anything. You just creatively rub your sticks together or you know, have your stone soup. But the truth is, I would say, you know, where we are, a town of 9,000, we have done well, but we're also close to New York City. So I don't have an answer for that. I hope that anybody could. And, you know, that where you run out of warm bodies, you have a lot of natural resources to mix with those bodies to make things interesting. But yeah, density can be an issue. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Sort of. I'm happy you're in a cool town now. And I hope that all of you will go out and think in bridges, because it's a very exciting time to be in this country. I know what it sounds like. There's a narrative of division, and I find the narrative itself to be very destructive. So don't believe the hype. things people are finding really interesting ways of collaborating. And I always say the opposite of division is not unity, it's collaboration. And that's what I see happening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.